Hey, football fans, BetMGM is giving you the chance to win up to $250,000 in bonus bets. It's all part of BetMGM's longest touchdown jackpot, where you'll be able to split the grand prize with anyone else who bet on the longest touchdown of the week. Log into your BetMGM account today and opt into the promo. Then, place an anytime touchdown wager of $10 or more on the player of your choice up to one player per game. If your player scores the longest touchdown of the week, you'll win a share of the $250,000. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This U.S. promotional offer is not available in Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. For New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369. For Arizona, 1-800-NEXT-STEP. For Massachusetts, 1-800-327-5050. For Iowa, 1-800-BETS-OFF. For Puerto Rico, 1-800-981-0023. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are unrestricted bonus dollars that expire in 7 days. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
Joe Montana here. In my football days, I knew the importance of a strong defense. Now I'm sharing how you can help defend your health against pneumococcal pneumonia and invasive pneumococcal disease. Are you 50 or older like me? The CDC now recommends vaccination against pneumococcal disease. Even if you're healthy, your age puts you at increased risk and over 6 times greater risk of hospitalization with pneumococcal pneumonia than adults under 50. Schedule your appointment today at vaxassist.com.
Sponsored by Pfizer.
Hello and welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Katie Halper.
I'm Mary Matte. Thanks so much for joining us. Our website is usefulidiotspodcast.com. Go there to support the show and get bonus content, including the Thursday Throwdown, your midweek dose of media madness, where basically after Monday morning, there's all these other clips that happen in the media. So what happens is on Thursday, the Thursday Throwdown, we make fun of all those clips that happen in between Monday morning and, let's say, whenever we record it, which is, you know, late Wednesday. So
yeah.
You're getting truly the madness of the midweek. And if you're not getting the Thursday Throwdown, you're missing out on all that madness.
If you're not getting Thursday Throwdown, what are you actually doing with your life? What are you getting from life?
And how are you getting over that the hump day? You know, hump how day. Are you getting over the midweek? It's that's what we're there to do. So that's at usefulidiotspodcast.com.
All righty. Shall we start with the four basic food groups? Let's go with Democrats suck. What do we got, Aaron?
One of Trump's first moves after taking office for the second time was to revoke the security clearances of a number of former intelligence officials who signed that letter infamously declaring that the Hunter Biden laptop was a Russian operation. And now John Brennan, former director of the CIA turned analyst on Democratic media outlet MSNBC, is here to clear his name because he wants you to know that contrary to what Trump said, he never, ever claimed that the Hunter Biden laptop was Russian disinformation. This is John Brennan's clarification.
As you pointed out, he misrepresented the facts in that executive order because it said that we had suggested that the Hunter Biden laptop story was Russian disinformation. No, we said it was for the hallmarks of Russian information operations, including the dumping of accurate information, which is what we said in that letter.
So John Brennan is outraged because his good reputation has been besmirched by Donald J. Trump, because John Brennan wants you to know he never said the Hunter Biden laptop was Russian disinformation. He, in fact, said it was a Russian information operation, Russia spreading accurate information in a bid to smear Hunter Biden. First of all, I think it's a distinction without a difference, because the point is, whether you think the Hunter Biden laptop was disinformation or actual emails, the point is the claim that it came from Russia was a lie. It was disinformation. The whole point of making this declaration that Brennan and these other former intelligence officials did was to discredit the reporting on the Hunter Biden laptop and by dismissing it as the work of Russia. Whether it's disinformation or accurate doesn't really matter. And second of all, the other problem here is that the way this was presented in the media by these intelligence officials and their media stenographers, which they never corrected and in fact spread themselves, was that this was indeed Russian disinformation. So for those who forget, look at how Politico, which was the first to report this claim from Brennan and these others, look how they reported it back in 2020. Hunter Biden's story is Russian disinfo, dozens of former intelligence officials say. Did John Brennan go out of his way to correct Natasha Bertrand and Politico? No, they let this lie spread. And in fact, when Brennan's close colleague, James Clapper, the former director of national intelligence, when he went on CNN, he also explicitly said that this was indeed disinformation. This is his exchange at the time with Aaron Burnett of CNN.
And to me, this is just classic textbook Soviet-Russian tradecraft at work. The Russians have analyzed the target. They understand that the president and his enablers crave dirt on Vice President Biden, whether it's real or contrived, it doesn't matter to them. And so all of a sudden, two and a half weeks before the election, this laptop appears somehow emails on it without any metadata.
So you see what he's doing there? He's saying, you know, real or contrived, but then he goes and pushes the line that it's contrived because he says these emails have appeared without any metadata, which means that they would be faked. And just to put a button on that, Clapper then makes this point again in response to Aaron Burnett.
Do you think stuff like that could just have been planted in there and be completely fake?
I do. I think the emails could be contrived, particularly since, as I understand it from what I've read, they appear without any metadata. That is, you know, from, to, and any technical data, at least immediately evident.
So there's James Clapper, who signed this letter along with John Brennan, pushing this notion, this fake notion, that the data on the laptop was contrived, aka it's disinformation. So that claim was a lie, as is the claim that this came from Russia, because the laptop actually came from Hunter Biden when he dropped it off at a Delaware repair shop. And now John Brennan wants you to know that's not what they intended. And it's just so funny that this story, which was just such a lie, continues to persist so many years later and people are still defending it.
Yeah, and that they lie so shamelessly about it.
And that's what intelligence officials do. And meanwhile, these same people are up in arms about Tulsi Gabbard coming in. There's a big controversy over her nomination to be the successor to someone like James Clapper, who formerly served in that role. Well, you know, whatever you can say about Tulsi Gabbard, there's a lot to criticize, but she never pushed an outright scam like the Hunter Biden laptop is Russian disinformation story, or the Iraq WMD hoax, which both John Brennan and James Clapper pushed. In fact, James Clapper in his memoir, he has this line where he says, you know, in trying to get intelligence that matched what the Bush administration wanted us to say, it seems like we were looking for things that weren't actually there. So that's a euphemistic way of saying that they lied. They lied. Right. And that's what intelligence officials do. And that's what they did here with the Hunter Biden laptop story.
Wow. Well, that certainly is a lot of Democrats sucking. So for Republicans suck, those of you who are lucky enough to give yourselves the gift of Thursday Throwdown, you saw us comment on some really interesting things that Elise Stefanik, Trump's pick for UN ambassador, had to say about the West Bank. But that wasn't all that she had to say. So here is more of her being questioned by Senator Chris Van Hollen about her thoughts on Israel and Palestine. Let's take a look.
I asked you in my office also about whether Palestinians have the right of self-determination. My understanding was you said yes. Do you have a different answer today?
That was not the direct question that we discussed. I said the Palestinian people—
You believe the Palestinians have the right of self-determination?
I believe the Palestinian people deserve so much better than the failures that they've had.
We agree
from
on
terrorist
that. It's
leadership.
Just a pretty simple question.
And I believe we need
peace
in the region. Yeah. Of course they deserve human rights.
So—
I want to ensure that, number one, we bring the hostages home. I
so
want to
do
ensure-
all of us. Representative Stefanik, let me just ask you. I have 30 seconds left. I'm rarely surprised by answers in my office, but I did ask you whether you subscribe to the views of Finance Minister Smotrich. Smotrich. This is the Israeli Finance Minister Smotrich and the former National Security Minister Ben-Gvir, who believe that Israel has a biblical right to the entire West Bank. And in that conversation, you told me that, yes, you shared that view. Is that your view today?
Yes.
So there you have it. Elise Stefanik, not even pretending to believe that Palestinians have the right to self-determination. Now, that is usually something that people pretend that they believe in, even though they don't actually make it possible. Even though they don't provide any kind of like policy follow-up, they at least pay lip service to these very basic ideas of democracy, self-determination, blah, blah, blah. But she doesn't even do that. It's actually, maybe she's more honest than the other people.
Oh, well, she's so much more honest because that is the policy in Washington, bipartisan, right, to deny Palestinians the right to self-determination. That is the official policy. That's been every single president. No one has ever done anything remotely in the direction of granting Palestinians their minimal right to self-determination. Nothing. So she's making plain the policy, but it's just amazing that she feels comfortable admitting to it, because, you know, because if you're such a racist that you can't even pretend to support right. someone's right to self-determination, it just says a lot. But she doesn't care because she's so committed to Israel. And that line there where she's like, when she's asked if she supports Palestine's right to self-determination, she says they deserve so much more. Yeah. Right, than what they currently have. Okay, well, how about self-determination? Do they deserve right. that? The answer is no. No, in her eyes, they don't. And that, yeah. and this, by the way, this is the fundamental problem. This is that right there, that answer from her crystallizes why we have a Middle East conflict to begin with. It's because Israel, with U.S. support, is devoted to denying Palestinians the right to self-determination. That's what it's all about. That's where it all starts from. Both parties. So both parties are guilty for this, but Elise Stefanik represents that extreme wing that is so committed to this policy that they're open and willing to flaunt, that they just will not grant Palestinians the right to their own land, in their own ancestral homeland that was stolen from them.
So maybe she's qualified for the job, because maybe she's more honest than everyone else. And of course, Elise Stefanik is not honest. I mean, she's doing an obvious pivot away from this, kind of a deflection, but she won't say that they deserve self-determination. And she's also a reminder, she's one of the people who went after the university administrations for being anti-Semitic. And she did that in a really dishonest way. So she's at least consistent. But Elise Stefanik is not the only person who has interesting things to say about Israel and Palestine. Let's take a look at the guy who's pushing for her, Donald Trump, President Trump. Here is Trump talking about what he sees as the future for Gaza.
Gaza, boy, I looked at a picture of Gaza. Gaza is like a massive demolition site. That place is, it's really got to be rebuilt in a different way.
Do you plan to help it rebuilding Gaza?
I might. You know, Gaza is interesting. It's a phenomenal location. On the sea, best weather, you know, everything's good. It's like some beautiful things could be done with it, but it's very interesting. But some fantastic things could be done with Gaza.
There you have it. Trump making it quite plain that he's excited about some potential rebuilding of Gaza, maybe hinting at some real estate opportunities. And that should come as no surprise because, of course, his son-in-law also mentioned that. That it has wonderful beachfront property. And here's an interesting tidbit of news from Lever News. Days before the ceasefire, Jared Kushner doubled his stake in an Israeli firm invested in illegal settlements in the West Bank and Golan Heights. Now Trump is interested in rebuilding Gaza, a phenomenal location right on the sea, the best weather. That's maybe one of the differences between Trump and Biden. I think that, you know, Biden was really motivated by a racist Zionism. True ideologue, and Trump is motivated by real estate interests. And of course, being funded by Miriam Adelson, but I think mostly real estate, yeah.
What a choice.
Bigot, yeah.
The bigot versus the profiteer, right. Of course. Palestinians lose no matter what, and so does the rest of the world, because no matter what, all this is fuels is conflict and carnage.
Right. And, you know, I do want to, I feel like, Aaron, you're not really recognizing Trump in all his humanity. He too is a bigot. You're right, there is the element of war profiteering, but we should remember that he of course called Biden a Palestinian as a smear.
Very true. Yeah. That's true. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. I don't want to deny Trump his bigotry. Fair enough.
Yeah.
Isn't that weird? Continuing on the theme of bigots talking about Palestine, let's look at this controversy this week when Elon Musk, who has been upstaging President Trump, over the course of the last several weeks since Trump's election, Elon Musk caused a new stir when he gave what many interpreted to be a Nazi salute. It did look like a Nazi salute to me. What happened in the immediate aftermath? Well, people who love to accuse anyone and anything of anti-Semitism, if it is critical of Israel, rushed, of course, to defend Elon Musk. For example, the Anti-Defamation League, which put out this really long-winded statement urging everyone to take a step back and give Elon Musk a break. This is some of what the ADL said. This is a delicate moment. It's a new day, yet so many are on edge. Our politics are inflamed, and social media only adds to the anxiety. It seems Elon Musk made an awkward gesture in a moment of enthusiasm, not a Nazi salute. But again, we appreciate the people are on edge, blah, blah, blah. You know, to be honest with you, I actually strongly doubt personally that Elon Musk meant to give a Nazi salute. I do think he's an awkward guy. I do think, you know, he does have some, you know, far right views. So it's possible that subconsciously there is like a Nazi salute in him. But I don't think that was like certainly a conscious thing on his part. But regardless, it's just so funny that the ADL, which like screams anti-Semitism at college students protesting genocide, just rushes to give this like nuanced take about Elon defending him. And why do they do that? It's because Elon Musk has kissed the ring ever since Elon Musk got in trouble about some anti-Semitic things he said on Twitter. And then basically to repent, you know, became a stooge of the ADL and went to Auschwitz with Ben Shapiro and just tried to do PR to cover up for the fact that he had posted anti-Semitic messages, including going after the ADL. He had talked about them as a problem because they were trying to undermine his ad revenue on Twitter/X. So here, for example, is the headline for Musk's visit to Auschwitz. Elon Musk visits Auschwitz after uproar over anti-Semitic messages on X. And I should say, I can't remember if the messages were directed at the ADL, but certainly he was mad at the ADL because they were then using that controversy to undermine his ad revenue. And that's what the ADL does, is they do shakedowns. Like, they basically threaten to accuse you of being an anti-Semite unless you give them money and do what they want, which is kiss the ring of Israel, which is exactly what Elon Musk did. He went over and met with Benjamin Netanyahu. They toured sites of October 7th, spread false claims about what actually happened on October 7th, and basically did the manufacturing consent for genocide that the ADL does.
Yeah, I mean, I actually think that Elon Musk was probably intentionally doing this, but as a trolling exercise. I think he knew that there would be this a response. I think it's useful, though, extremely useful, because it does highlight the ADL's hypocrisy. And, you know, look, just so people have a sense of the kinds of comments that he did make on Twitter, the kinds of comments that got the ADL mad at him, he did say he did post back in November of 2023. He posted, Jewish communities have been pushing the exact kind of dialectical hatred against whites that they claim to want people to stop using against them. And his post also referred to hordes of minorities flooding Western countries. He quote tweeted that and said, you have said the actual truth. But as you said, Aaron, it's very useful to look at how the ADL doesn't care about anti-Semitism, because surely, if they did, they'd be more worried about the potential for Elon to have done that. And you know, the biggest point is that they don't give anyone the benefit of the doubt. In fact, there's actually footage of Jonathan Greenblatt, the head of the ADL, comparing keffiyehs to swastikas.
Yeah, they had some database where they counted anti-Semitic incidents, and they basically count any expression of protest against the genocide in Gaza as anti-Semitic. So, I mean, they have less than zero credibility.
Yeah. And, you know, we should also give credit to people like Batya Unger Sargon, who is at Newsweek. She is a very proud Zionist, and she was happy to come to the defense of Elon Musk. She said of Elon Musk, as a person with a strong track record of criticizing Elon Musk, I feel extremely confident asserting that this was not a Nazi salute. Elon Musk is a friend to the Jews. This is a man with Asperger's exuberantly throwing his heart to the crowd. We don't need to invent outrage. But that's interesting, because Batya was very quick to invent outrage at another point. I don't know if people remember the director, Jonathan Glazer, the director of Zone of Interest, this excellent film, at the Oscars. His acceptance speech said, right now, we stand here as men who refute their Jewishness and the Holocaust being hijacked by an occupation which has led to conflict for so many innocent people. Well, you know how Batya responded to that? She tweeted out, I simply cannot fathom the moral rot in someone's soul that leads them to win an award for a movie about the Holocaust, and with the platform given to them to accept that award by saying, we stand here as men who refute their Jewishness. So she somehow doesn't give them the benefit of the doubt of literally reading their full sentence.
But we are equal opportunity here. And so do you want to know who else I think has no credibility on the issue of white supremacy and Nazis? Democrats. Because of what they've done in Ukraine by supporting literal white supremacists and neo-Nazis. And One of them is named Chris Murphy. Let's first of all, before we get at this record in Ukraine, let's hear what he had to say about Elon Musk and this controversy.
And listen, what I think is so dangerous about this broader moment is that there are these signals being sent to really dangerous, fringe, violent groups on the right. Fringe right groups, white supremacists, neo-Nazis, that Trump's with you. The pardons essentially were a message that there is immunity for political violence. And all throughout Telegram and far-right channels on Monday night, that Musk neo-Nazi salute was being amplified as evidence.
Nick Fuentes thinks it was a Nazi salute.
I mean, Proud Boys, other groups saying Trump's got our back, right? The white supremacy cause is back in vogue. And that makes for an explosive moment politically and physically in our political space right now.
Okay, so that's Chris Murphy, you know, talking about white supremacy on the right, how it's supported, and there's a lot of truth to that. But I don't think he has any credibility on this topic, because in Ukraine, where Murphy was part of the U.S. delegation in December 2013 that encouraged regime change, Murphy cavorted with literal white supremacists and neo-Nazis. This, for example, is a photo of him and John McCain with one of them. So the man there on the far right of the screen, and also on the far right of the political spectrum, is named Ole Tanibuk. He was leader at the time of Ukraine's Svoboda Party. And what is Svoboda? Well, it's a party that the European Parliament, just 1 year before this picture was taken, had denounced as, quote, racist, anti-Semitic, and xenophobic, and urged any politician, quote, not to associate with, endorse, or form coalitions with. And that's because people like Tanibuk had said things like, we have to fight the, quote, Muscovite Jewish mafia running Ukraine, okay? And Chris Murphy went and cavorted with this guy, appeared with him on stage, and supported what became a coup in Ukraine just a few months later. And has Chris Murphy ever apologized for this? No, he's actually just supported groups like Svoboda and their allies, including in the Azov Battalion. The Biden administration last year, they lifted a State Department ban on arming the Azov Battalion, which is a neo-Nazi paramilitary group. And just to illustrate, you know, the hypocrisy of all this and like where liberal Western culture has whitewashed white supremacists inside Ukraine, just compare two Guardian headlines from different points in time. Look at this image here. At the top of the screen, that's a headline from 2018 in The Guardian. Neo-Nazi groups recruit Britons to fight in Ukraine. Okay. That's 2018 in The Guardian. This headline was from this month, so 2025 in The Guardian. Same topic of neo-Nazis recruiting foreigners to fight in Ukraine, but look at how they've changed it. Ukraine's highest profile combat unit to recruit English-speaking soldiers. And that unit is the same aforementioned neo-Nazi group, which is the Azov Battalion.
What changed, Aaron?
Well, change was Russia invaded finally in February 2022. And then after that, you couldn't say anymore that we were supporting neo-Nazis inside of Ukraine, or that the cyber war inside Ukraine was neo-Nazis. That's what's changed. So, and this includes, by the way, people like AOC, who's been leading the charge and calling out the hypocrisy around Elon. And fair enough, like I agree with her in going after the ADL. She's made some very good points, but she also has said nothing about the fact that we're arming neo-Nazis inside of Ukraine. And this doesn't mean that every military force in Ukraine is neo-Nazi. They are a minority, but they're a very strong minority, as is exemplified by the fact that Chris Murphy was on stage with one of their leaders back in 2013.
So isn't that terrible? We have a really terrible piece of news. Now, I'm not going to show the video, but there is a video that's been going viral on Twitter, and it shows an Israeli teenager throwing a kitten off of a balcony. And of course, he's like doing it gleefully, much like we see Israeli soldiers gleefully engaging in war crimes and genocide and gleefully posing in front of destroyed hospitals, gleefully wearing the lingerie of women that they've ethnically cleansed. We see this teenager, a 17-year-old, demonstrating the same gleeful sociopathy as he throws a kitten from the fifth floor balcony of his apartment building in Jerusalem. So what's interesting is that he's been arrested. Now, it is interesting that it seems like it's easier to arrest someone for throwing a kitten off the roof than it is to arrest someone for, let's say, if you're a soldier and you rape some Palestinians. Because as we know, when Israeli police tried to arrest soldiers who had raped Palestinian prisoners, Palestinian hostages, you know, Palestinian prisoners of genocide, basically, there were riots about it. There were riots about it. But I don't see any riots about the arrest of this boy. Who knows? Maybe they will have a, much like they had right to rape riots, maybe they'll have right to kill cat riots. But I also think it's an interesting contrast, this sociopathy that we see demonstrated by Israelis. And I should also note that his friends were there laughing at it, because what's funnier than throwing a kitten to its death? But let's contrast this behavior with the behavior of Palestinians who are being subjected to a genocide and yet somehow manage to show more compassion to their animals than Israelis do to Palestinian human beings. Let's take a look at some of these videos. So this is the girl saying she's going to leave her cat behind. An adorable cat. The shelling started, so we left and I took her with me. Here's a boy, a teenage boy, who has rescued a cat from the rubble, and he himself is bleeding and covered in dust. And then he's at the hospital, and we see him at the hospital being tended to, and he has his cat on his lap as he's lying down on a hospital bed. And there's tons more footage of people not only taking care of them and rescuing them, but also giving them food. And we're talking about people who don't even have enough food for themselves. So that's my, isn't that terrible on the one hand, and isn't that also inspiring and incredibly moving on the other hand?
Well, this is an example of the contrast between an occupying population and the occupied. The occupier has to become a monster to be able to justify what they're doing and carry it out. And there's something about being the target of oppression that forces you to dig deep until your reservoirs of humanity to be able to survive. And nobody embodies that more than Palestinians in terms of finding their humanity. And no one embodies evil, I think, more on this planet than the Israeli government, which is just taking a decades-long military occupation founded on ethnic cleansing into a genocide over the last year plus.
And unfortunately, it trickles down. It's not just the government, because obviously Israel is a society that's fully militarized. Everyone, with some exceptions, like religious exemptions, serves in the military. And given that the military is kind of the instrument of genocide, I think it trickles down to people who are not active soldiers. That's why you see people throwing cats from roofs. And also, one other thing is that in terms of the difference in the treatment of hostages, we saw a girl, an Israeli captive. We saw her being able to be released by Hamas, also with her little adorable Shih Tzu. So she was able to keep her dog, and the dog was able to survive also. So just, again, huge contrast.
And those have been your four basic food groups. If you asked our critics, they'd tell you that Useful Idiots is a secret agent podcast funded by foreign governments. But you listen to Useful Idiots, you know we're American made. And at a time when it feels like most of our money is being sent overseas to fund weapons dealers, we want to show some support for a company that's doing their best to give good jobs to American workers and really good clothes too. It's American Giant. And since 2011, they've been making high-quality, long-lasting, timeless American clothes, including their classic Full Zip, which was named the greatest hoodie ever made by Slate magazine. From activewear to work fits to the latest fashion picks, American Giant has it all. Check out the premium Slub Crew Tee, the No BS high-rise pant, and the slim roughneck pant featured in Giant magazine. When most apparel companies have shipped too much overseas, making cheap disposable clothes, and creating complicated global supply chains, American Giant stands for simple, local, high-quality goods. When you buy American Giant, you create local jobs in towns that help stitch communities together. Get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com when you use code USEFUL at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com. Code USEFUL.
Hey, football fans, BetMGM is giving you the chance to win up to $250,000 in bonus bets. It's all part of BetMGM's longest touchdown jackpot, where you'll be able to split the grand prize with anyone else who bet on the longest touchdown of the week. Log into your BetMGM account today and opt into the promo. Then, place an anytime touchdown wager of $10 or more on the player of your choice up to one player per game. If your player scores the longest touchdown of the week, you'll win a share of the $250,000. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This U.S. promotional offer is not available in Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. For New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369. For Arizona, 1-800-NEXT-STEP. For Massachusetts, 1-800-327-5050. For Iowa, 1-800-BETS-OFF. For Puerto Rico, 1-800-981-0023. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are unrestricted bonus dollars that expire in 7 days. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
It's a new year, 2025, and you're probably thinking, how am I going to make this year different? How can I make this the best year ever? How am I going to build something for myself? I'm dying to be my own boss or see if I can turn this business idea I've been kicking around into a reality. But I don't know how to make that happen. Shopify is the key, and let me tell you how. The best time to start your new business is right now. Shopify makes it simple to create your brand, open for business, and get your first sale. Get your store up and running easily with thousands of customizable templates. No coding or design skills required. All you need to do is drag and drop. Their powerful social media tools let you connect all your channels and create shoppable posts and help you sell everywhere people scroll. Shopify makes it easy to manage your growing business. They help with details like shipping, taxes, and payments from one single dashboard, allowing you to focus on the important stuff, like growing your business. What happens if you don't act now? Will you regret it? What if someone beats you to the idea? Don't kick yourself when you hear this again in a year because you didn't do anything now. With Shopify, your first sale is closer than you think. Established in 2025. Has a nice ring to it, doesn't it? Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle to start selling with Shopify today. shopify.com/redcircle.
We are really excited to be speaking to Arnaud Bertrand, who is a French entrepreneur. He lived in China for 8 years. And he has a really excellent analysis of China, of the relationship between China and the West. And you should definitely follow him on Twitter, where his handle is Arnaud Bertrand. That's R-N-A-U-D-B-E-R-T-R-A-N-D. And he's going to talk to us about many things, including TikTok. Arnaud Bertrand, thank you so much for joining.
Well, thank you so much for the invitation.
Of course. You have so many insights into so many different areas, but I thought we would start off with TikTok because I think that's a subject that's on everyone's minds. What are your thoughts on what is happening right now with TikTok? And can you just set up the history of TikTok?
Yes. So it's quite complicated because quite a lot happened. So basically, TikTok is the international version of a Chinese app called Douyin, which is set up by a Chinese company called ByteDance. And so, as everyone knows, it's grown extremely popular in the West. I think the number of users in the US is 170 million, if I'm not mistaken. What's happened, I mean, I guess I don't need to tell people that is there was this project to ban it in the US. A lot of people refer to it as reciprocity with what China is doing with a lot of American apps. But I think it's important to dispel this notion because it's not exactly correct. What China has done is basically saying that, you know, there are some rules that all the companies have to abide by, you know, on censorship, data storage, all the data needs to be stored in China, and so on and so forth. And basically, if you don't abide by those rules, you can't operate in China. And so all the companies, American companies that are actually blocked by the, what you call the Great Firewall in China, are companies that don't abide by China's rules. The TikTok thing is very different because TikTok actually abides by all the rules, even on censorship, because there are some rules on censorship in the US. And, you know, there were a lot of articles around the fact that they had hired a lot of ex-CIA, ex-FBI, and so on in their team to monitor their content and so on. So they're playing the game. So they're not getting banned because of that, but purely because they're a Chinese company. And the law is actually, if you stop being a Chinese company, if you sell to us, basically, then you're not getting banned. So it's a very different nature from what China is doing. And what happened is as the ban was about to take effect, you saw this migration, which is I think a first in the history of US-China relations, where a lot of TikTok users migrated to another Chinese service called Xiaohongshu. RedNote is the English name, as sort of a protest movement to, find another platform where they could post content if TikTok was indeed getting banned, and also, you know, express their discontent with the American government by going on an actual Chinese platform, because Xiaohongshu is, on TikTok, you always say that it's Chinese, but there are no Chinese users and there is no Chinese content. All the content there is generated in the West by Western users, and all the Chinese content on TikTok is actually on Douyin. It's not on TikTok at all, whereas Xiaohongshu is a pure Chinese platform with, before the migration, only Chinese users and only Chinese content. So it's quite funny to see that how that all backfired in order to stop Chinese influence in social media in the US. Then you get a migration movement to an app that actually is orders of magnitude. As orders of magnitude more Chinese influence.
Right.
And then the latest episode, of course, Trump moved to unban TikTok. I mean, it remains to be seen what will happen, but at least TikTok is back online in the US with some added censorship in, apparently. I mean, some people are sharing that there are some things that they can't express anymore, like Free Palestine or things like that. I don't know exactly what happened there, but So that's basically the whole episode as it happened.
And so did China have to change RedNote to make it accessible to people outside of China?
No, it was accessible. Yeah, but there were some changes because at first there was no translation function, for instance. So you had those American users just posting stuff in English and then the Chinese users replying in Chinese. And no one had any idea what they were saying to each other. So they added a bunch of features in order to make the exchanges more smooth. But otherwise it was fully open before. And actually you had some very touching moments. One of the very trendy things right now is something called, Letters by Li Hua, where it's extremely viral on Xiaohongshu right now, where at school, a lot of Chinese people, as English homework, they had to write letters to an imaginary, friend in the US, Simon or whatever, and they would always have to sign as someone called Li Hua. Like, imagine you're Li Hua sending a letter to someone in the US. And of course, they all knew that that letter was never going to be read by anyone. But what a lot of Chinese users are doing right now is they're posting those letters from their, you know, school homework like 10, 20 years ago on Xiaohongshu. And you have Americans replying, you know, saying, I'm sorry it took me so long to reply to your letter. So you have quite touching exchanges like that. It's actually very, very nice to see, you know, you have the awful rhetoric at the top on the tension, geopolitical tension between China and the US, but it's nice to see that there is still some way for the people to actually connect.
So another example of like the US bringing people together unintentionally, kind of like they do with China and Russia also.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
What about DeepSeek? What is DeepSeek and what is the relationship between DeepSeek and TikTok and also OpenAI?
Okay, so there is no relationship between DeepSeek and TikTok. So DeepSeek is basically a sub company of like almost like a side project of a Chinese hedge fund who they bought an awful lot of GPUs because, you know, they do quant stuff, like they trade with algorithms and so on. And those GPUs, they couldn't use when the market was closed. And so they said, you know, in order to make use of those GPUs that we have anyway, let's just hire a couple of guys to basically build LLM, large language model, you know, on the side with those GPUs when they aren't used. And the funny thing is that LLM now is, there have been a few versions of it, but it comes on par with the top American LLMs, like, ChatGPT, the latest models, Claude from Anthropic and so on. And they're offering it essentially for free, open source. You can either use their API at a cost 3% the cost of the API of OpenAI, or you can use it for free by downloading it and running it on your own server or computer, which is also quite extremely impactful because it completely questions the whole business model of OpenAI, because you have this competitor rising out of nowhere, like this hedge fund doing that as their side project. They only spent $6 million to develop the LLM, when OpenAI spent hundreds of millions. And they come up with something that's just as good, actually even better on a lot of benchmarks, and they're offering it for free. So that's an interesting development as well. And it's becoming extremely popular. If you check Twitter right now, everyone's speaking about AI, like they're adopting DeepSeek massively because it's free and it's just as good. So why not?
Wow. Going back to the TikTok discussion, can you talk about the way that Palestine and Israel are covered on TikTok? Because I think contrary to popular belief, there is actually censorship of that issue, right? But it's despite that censorship that you still see more pro-Palestine content just because of, I think, the demographics of who's on TikTok. So can you talk about the way Palestine and Israel are kind of treated and presented on TikTok and how that perhaps has given more enthusiasm to the attempt to ban it?
Yeah, so, full disclaimer, I don't use TikTok, so I'm not that familiar with the discussions going on there. I've just seen some, numbers shared that, indeed, there were way more pro-Palestinian posts than pro-Israeli, but that's a reflection of society, right? Especially when you look at that demographic, of young users. And I don't see how that's significantly different from X, for instance. I'm on X every day. And I see, you know, orders of magnitude more pro-Palestinian content than pro-Israeli. So while that may have been used as an argument maybe to sway some congressmen who are, you know, very pro-Israeli and so on, I don't think that is the main reason behind the TikTok ban. I think the main reason, plus, as you say, there were some articles on the fact that they do censor content. They do have like all the national security types in their team. The data is stored in the US with Oracle, which is headed by a very, pro-Israeli guy. So I don't think that is, I know a lot of people are saying that that is the main deal with TikTok, but I don't think it is. I think the main deal is the fact that it is a Chinese platform, and they want American companies to have a monopoly on social media.
Trump has now ordered, very smartly, taking advantage of the Democrats banning TikTok, even though Trump actually tried to do it when he was in office the first time. Yeah. Trump has ordered a delay of this ban for 75 days, and now he thinks he can push through, I guess, some kind of deal that forces ByteDance to sell its American stake in TikTok. Do you think ByteDance will go for that? Do they have any incentive to do that? I'm curious also, like, your thoughts as an entrepreneur. I mean, how normal is this that a government can try to force a major company to try to just sell itself? As this is the kind of stuff that, like, Cuba would get accused of and talking about the evils of communism, like appropriating enterprises. And now it's like the Trump administration, preceded by the Biden administration, trying to do the same thing.
Yeah. I think it's, I mean, if this goes through, it sets a very worrying precedent, because basically what it's saying is that if as a foreign tech company, a non-American tech company, you make it big, and there aren't that many when you think about it. I think TikTok is actually the only non-US social media that made it this big. So that situation itself is unprecedented. And the message that it's sending is, if you do make it big, then basically we're going to try to colonize you. It's digital colonialism in a way. So that's a very bad precedent. I think that's, I can't speak to what TikTok or ByteDance is going to do, but I think we all have a big collective interest in, as non-Americans, I mean, anyone who is outside the US who wants to have entrepreneurs that do make it big coming from their country has an interest in not getting this precedent set, right? Because then, you know, it completely destroys the incentive for any country. Like, it's already so hard to succeed given the odds on how dominated the landscape is by American VCs, American tech companies, and so on. If you're one of the lucky few that finally make it, then you're forced to sell to the Americans. It's definitely not right. And that's a precedent that I don't think should be set.
As Aaron alluded to, I mean, it is kind of ironic that the United States government, which presents itself as this bastion of free speech, entrepreneurship, free market, where the government doesn't meddle, it's ironic that they are doing exactly that. I mean, we're used to the hypocrisy, I think, around free speech, but it is pretty funny that they vilify China as this country that has a government that is controls everything, right? No. Whereas we, in theory, have a free market, right? The invisible hand. And yet we're doing exactly that when it comes to a very popular Chinese platform.
Yeah. And I mean, TikTok is not the first. Huh? It's we had an interesting precedent in France. I don't know if you followed this story, the Alstom story.
Oh, yeah. Please talk about that.
yeah, we got one of our biggest company, most iconic company, literally stolen by the Americans. they put one of the top executives in jail in the US until the company sold itself to GE. So that was a false sale as well. It's something that that they've done previously, and they tried to do something similar-ish with Huawei, where they also captured the daughter of the founder in Canada. Actually, Canada acted on the US behalf. And there was this whole fight on the, unlike France, which yielded and sold Alstom to GE, China fought to the bitter end all the way until Meng Wanzhou, who was the daughter of the founder of Huawei, got released. So, yeah, it is as you say, extremely hypocritical. It's like, it's free market for American companies. Like, you should welcome us freely. But as soon as there is any, you know, challenge from foreign companies, then the free market doesn't stand anymore.
Can you talk more about this digital colonialism that you just referred to and the different iterations of colonialism that we're seeing, like neocolonialism that we see when it comes to the relationship between the West and China?
Yes. Yeah, so, I mean, digital colonialism, it's actually something that is done on most countries, but not China, because China was smart enough to recognize that the digital world was a territory, and that they had to keep their sovereignty over it. That's why they erected the so-called Great Firewall, which enabled them to have their own ecosystem of companies emerge and not be completely dominated by American companies. And when you look around the world, that's pretty much the only place where that happened, right? If you look at Europe, where I come from, the picture is extraordinarily bleak. You literally have, I mean, the only example, I guess, is Spotify. But then again, they are now headquarters in the US. And apart from them, you have virtually no European big success story. If you look at all the European presidents, to speak to their own population right now, they have to use American social media, which is, you know, kind of strange when you think about it, to express, to shape the narrative from for your own population through Twitter, X, Facebook, Instagram, and so on, which is controlled by the American. It's really like a sword of Damocles over your head. It's strategically speaking, it's not healthy at all.
I was hoping that you could respond to this clip of Donald Trump. Here he's vowing to hit the European Union with tariffs and saying that his administration was discussing a 10% punitive duty on Chinese imports by February 1 because fentanyl is being sent from China to the US via Mexico and Canada. So let's take a look and then get your reaction.
We're talking about a tariff of 10% on China based on the fact that they're sending fentanyl to Mexico and Canada.
So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, Trump does love his tariffs, doesn't he? I mean, the fentanyl stuff is, I think it's largely bullshit. I looked at it at some point. China doesn't send fentanyl, first of all. What they sell is a precursor to the drug, which can have multiple use. It's as far as I remember, it's stuff that is widely used in the pharmaceutical industry and so on. So it's actually quite hard to understand it's hard for China to track down after they sell the stuff if it's going to be used to make fentanyl or not. And the fentanyl is actually not made in China, but I guess in Mexico or, Latin America. So the I don't know the measure of control that China would have around that. I think it's just an excuse to put a 10% tariff. And then tariff, I don't think it's, at the end of the day, it's something that's paid by the American people. It's a tax on the American people. It's not something that that China is paying. It's just going to make everything more expensive, basically, for Americans. I guess the hope is that as tariffs rise, American manufacturing is going to take over. But that takes years to set up manufacturing. And do Americans really want to get back to manufacturing jobs anyway? Will there ever be manufacturing has changed a lot. It's a lot robotized. America is way behind in that. So all of this is, I think it's a strategy that at the end of the day is just going to make things more expensive. And I don't think, I don't buy the great American manufacturing revival, or if it ever going to happen, it's going to take a very long time.
Yeah. I mean, great job to everyone who deindustrialized the U.S. and shipped jobs overseas and is now thinking they can make up for it by just imposing tariffs on everybody else who actually still does have a manufacturing base. But Trump loves tariffs so much that he's even threatening tariffs on Russia. He said in a post he put out the other day that, like, if Putin doesn't negotiate a peace deal in Ukraine, he'll be forced to impose new tariffs on Russia. And my first reaction was like, well, what is there to impose a tariff on? Because there is basically no trade right now between the U.S. and Russia because of the Ukraine war, because of all the sanctions that the U.S. imposed on Russia in response to that. So I'm not even sure what he could do there tariff-wise if he wanted to. And, you know, as someone I know who's followed the Ukraine war very closely, what is your response to that? That Trump basically saying that he's already willing to threaten Russia immediately with tariffs and sanctions as if Russia isn't already sanctioned extensively. And what is there to tariff if there's no trade?
Yeah, I think there is still a tiny bit of trade between Russia and the US on, strategic commodities that there are a lot of commodities out there that only Russia is selling, right? A lot of rare minerals and so on. And so when you say you're going to tariff Russia on those, Russia is like, presumably like, suit yourselves. We're the only ones who sell those stuff. So it's like basically saying we're going to pay more for your stuff. That makes very little sense. And then in terms of sanctions, Russia is already probably the most sanctioned country on earth. If you think like they're out of the, completely out of the Western financial system, out of the, how is it called? This Belgian company that links banking. They're an enormous amount of sanctions has been put on them. We've seen the results. The Russian economy is actually doing very well. It's actually the fastest growing economy in Europe. It's pushed them on China much closer together. It's really started a much bigger divide between the West and the rest, with the rest more aligning on Russia's side than the US. So it's very strange for Trump to sort of double down on this failed strategy. I don't really understand. I think it speaks more to the fact that Trump is trying. I think he wants a deal, and he's trying to sound tough, but he doesn't have anything to threaten Russia with, right? Like save for actual war, which he will not do. So he's just, you know, putting out threats that are meaningless, and it reveals the weak strategic position that he's in ahead of the negotiation, because he has nothing to really damaging to threaten Russia with.
Can you talk about the role of China in the both now and historically, since the Russia's invasion of Ukraine in that conflict, and how they try to intervene or facilitate a peace deal?
And to hear the rest of the interview, please go to usefulidiotspodcast.com.
So that is our interview with Arnaud Bertrand. And you'll definitely, if you're not already subscribers to usefulidiotspodcast.com, you'll want to be, because in the Substack-only portion of the interview, he talks about a lot of fascinating things, including myths about China, the claim that China is predatory with Africa, and the claim that China is engaging in a genocide of the Uyghurs. And again, that's at usefulidiotspodcast.com.
A guy with a heavy French accent take on China. Where else are you going to get that? Mm-hmm. But Useful Idiots. And I'm very grateful to Arnaud, who I follow on X/Twitter, who's very insightful, and great to meet him and hear from him and get his take. Very, very interesting stuff. So thank you to Arnaud for joining us. And thank you for tuning into Useful Idiots. Our website is usefulidiotspodcast.com. Go there to support the show. Get bonus content. We'll see you next time.
Bye, everyone.
Thanks so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For extended episodes, bonus content, and our weekly Thursday Throwdown episode, please subscribe at usefulidiotspodcast.com. Support the show for free by subscribing on YouTube, Rumble, and wherever you get your podcasts. If you like the podcast, don't forget to rate and review. You can also follow us on Twitter at usefulidiotpod. Thanks for supporting independent media. We'll see you next time.
Hey, football fans, BetMGM is giving you the chance to win up to $250,000 in bonus bets. It's all part of BetMGM's longest touchdown jackpot, where you'll be able to split the grand prize with anyone else who bet on the longest touchdown of the week. Log into your BetMGM account today and opt into the promo. Then, place an anytime touchdown wager of $10 or more on the player of your choice, up to one player per game. If your player scores the longest touchdown of the week, you'll win a share of the $250,000. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This U.S. promotional offer is not available in Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. For New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369. For Arizona, 1-800-NEXT-STEP. For Massachusetts, 1-800-327-5050. For Iowa, 1-800-BETS-OFF. For Puerto Rico, 1-800-981-0023. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are unrestricted bonus dollars that expire in 7 days. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.